that are motivation. Everything that appears to us, to our sense consciousnesses, appears very real, appears as some sort of objective reality. And we completely buy into that appearance and hold it to be true. And so, in our ordinary life, there's these things out there that we like, and there's these things out there that we don't like, and they're all very real and very solid. And this person that we are, who likes and doesn't like, is also very solid. And we might even say, oh, my mind's under the influence of attachment or aversion. The attachment and the aversion are very solid. And then we just struggle. You know, we struggle in the middle of this whole scene that we've created that doesn't exist in the way that it appears. So it's good to reflect a bit on dependent arising and see how these things that appear so solid to us exist by being merely labeled independence upon a base. That there's nothing out there in the base. There's just these various components. And then our mind conceptualizes and makes them into a thing. But from the side of the object, there's not that thing inherently there inside the base. So when we reflect like this, then things soften a bit. So we don't fight as much against all these things that we see outside. We don't fight as much with ourselves inside. Things just get a little bit softer. So this is the view that we want to cultivate. That will help us really work for the benefit of sentient beings. Because by seeing things as dependent arising and empty at the same time in a non-contradictory way, then we'll be able to purify our mind of the defilements that prevent us from being of the greatest benefit. All living beings. Contemplate that for a moment. Okay, so how are you this week? Depends upon which 5 minutes I happen to ask the question on. Because your mind changes a lot?
Yeah. Everything that you said in the past 5 minutes is exactly what I'm saying all week. And, you know, I've gotten to the ultimate root of the deity, the first deity of the self-generation, I've been sitting there all week.
Uh-huh. That's a good place to sit.
And I think for me to really get to to really start thinking about the object to be engaged is to really see how big and hard and fast and tight and solid this I is that I've come to. And a part of it is this whole thing about how the senses, you know, everything that comes in from my eyes and my ears and my nose and my hands, it immediately gets compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. And then it gets built. And it's part of my way to keep myself, the I, from other. And depending on how attached I am or how aversion to whatever's coming into my senses, mm-hmm. that I like it, I don't like it, I don't care, it determines on how big an O that other begins with. So if it's really kind of a small other, it's a small O, you know, it's the neutral. But if it's a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling, depending on, and it's like my mind has, if there's nothing going on, my ego will find something to make, it prefers big O's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just walking into the room.
Yeah.
And it'll make a big O out of that whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've been just spending the whole week just looking at how she's just sitting in this concrete, boxed in, tight, hard and fast thing with all this stuff coming off from the outside, and that she thinks that she's seeing everything really, really clearly. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's a retreat and it's quiet and it's really nice here, and I've been doing this for a while and I should be really trying to see things a little bit more clearly. And this is actually getting a lot more clear on how solid and how concrete and how hard making it up. And at the same time that I've been sitting this object to be negated, trying to see how big I actually have conjured up this whole reality of mine, I've been listening to the tapes on the three principal aspects of the path, and I'm doing a non-contact meditation right now. And about 7 years ago, I had a really, really profound effect when we led the meditation on imagining your death at a retreat. And re-listening to those 9 points this week, and realizing that death is definite and that time of death is uncertain, and at this very moment, from what I've observed about myself and how I see myself in this world, if death were to come to me tonight, I would be in terror. I would have white knuckles. I would be screaming out of sight. And that I think it's the first time since I have heard these teachings that it's getting onto a deeper level. It's about, man, this is no joke.
Mm-hmm.
It could happen in the next minute. And you've really got to get some understanding about this, because you're spending way too much time nitpicking at people, at things, at situations. You're spending all your energy on things that just don't matter. Mm-hmm. I go outside the meditation hall and I look outside and I see this beautiful sky. I say, man, someday this will be gone. You think even last night you'll see those stars? We don't know. And that the third part of that 9 point is that the only thing that matters after death is the Dharma. And do you really believe that?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's been and how in these teachings you were spent, I think you spent about 4 weeks on that, those two line verse by contemplating the leisures and fortunes so difficult to find in the fleeting nature of this life. And verse the clinging to this life. By contemplating the fallible effects of karma, the miseries of suffering existence, you must be clinging to future. And you've been just talking about this and permanent so past four tapes I've listened to, and it's like I'm hearing it in my head. And I want that feeling that I'm getting to be able to work as an antidote to this solid, concrete, conceptualized, hard and fast illusion I've been going on. That's where I am at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really, really grateful that those teachings are there. And I remember last week when Karen said, don't you get irritated how many times you have to teach the same subject over and over again? But it's like as many times as you teach it, that's as many times as we maybe have to hear until they're going on another level. Because I went through this whole thing that I've heard this. I've heard this before. I went through that when I was transcribing. And you said, and then in the teaching, you say, Jeff is Jeff, what's for lunch? It's exactly the mind I had when I was transcribing.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jeff, this is your mind. What she paid. So anyway, it's been really a nice, fruitful day. Very nice, fruitful day.
Good. How are the people doing?
I have uncontrollable laughing fit. I think it's just so far as irritating me so much. I think it's irritating everybody else. And it's just not based on anything. Just on stupid things that normally wouldn't even seem sweet. So it's just been just goofy, just still goofy. But I have just a bajillion of questions, but mine are more, because you guys are all doing, you know, the South generation. I don't know. So is it okay?
Yes, yeah, sure.
So what I was wondering, one of the things was, when you visualize, you know, to have an interest in something, you have to be sort of attracted to it, or there has to be something that you value in it, or something like that. So when we're developing that sort of, I'll just use the word attraction, but that's not the right word, I don't think, toward, in relation to Chinlezi, what is that? It's not, you know what I mean? It's based on faith. It's based on...
Okay, so you're saying, like if you feel attracted then towards something, then your mind is more interested, and so in creating that feeling of attraction. And I think attraction is fine to use towards Chinlezi, but what helps you develop that feeling? I think it's contemplating Chinlezi's qualities, and so contemplating the qualities is also what helps faith to arise and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think about physical qualities, and if you look just Chinrezi's whole body, you know, just the body language, the body position, the eyes, everything, you know, if you spend some time visualizing that, it's so completely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to look into those eyes and to think, like, what would my eyes look like if they were like that? You know? I mean, it really, what's the word? Not enhances, entices in something that makes you, just, you know, feel involved. And, you know, think about the qualities of an enlightened one's body, being able to make all those manifestations and do so many things to help others. And then think of the qualities of a Buddha's speech, the principal quality, and the principal way they say the Buddha's benefit sentient beings is by using their speech to teach the Dharma. And so, you know, how a Buddha teaches, and everybody hears in a way that accords with their karma and their capability in speaking the truth and being skillful in the speech. And, you know, contemplating those kinds of qualities. You can read in the long name about them more. And then especially thinking of the qualities of Buddha's mind, the wisdom, the compassion, what it means to have those kind of qualities, and the kind of, you know, what it means to be omniscient and to have these various psychic powers so that you're really able to benefit sentient beings, and having no ego that gets in the way of using those powers to benefit others. And so, you know, thinking about these qualities and thinking Chinrezi has these, then it develops, of the three kinds of faith, it develops the admiring faith, because you admire the qualities, and then based on that, you can develop the aspiring faith that aspires yourself to generate those qualities. And that really makes a feeling of closeness to Chenrezig.
So when you're visualizing, you know, the image of Chenrezig, interceptive alertness is the thing that initially finds it, right? The image itself?
Actually, it's mindfulness.
That finds it or holds it?
Mindfulness remembers the thing. I mean, you have to have attention, first of all, on the object. But then mindfulness holds it in such a way that you don't forget it.
So mindfulness finds it.
Mindfulness it also can be translated as memory. It has something to do with memory because you're remembering the object that you're focusing on. So you may have looked at a tanka or something, you know, and then you remember that, but then your mindfulness, you know, you put your attention on that, but then your mindfulness holds it. Okay. And then the introspective alertness makes sure that you're not wandering off. It's interesting that this factor of introspective alertness, in the Theravada tradition, it's translated as clear comprehension. Mm-hmm. Because it's actually a form of wisdom. The Tibetan term is shinshe, and she is the same she as in she rab, which means intelligence or wisdom, or yes she, it's the same she. So it's it has some factor of understanding or wisdom in it. So I think it's interesting they translated from Pali to English as clear comprehension. Okay. So there's some understanding of the object that's coming, and also some understanding of, you know, if you've gotten distracted, it's how to bring your mind back.
So what causes clarity of the object? Is about
this clarity is, let me think, because there's stability and clarity. Clarity is just going back over the object again and again. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. You go back over it again and again, mm-hmm. and then you place your mind on it. Mm-hmm. And to have clarity, you have to have a mind that is free of dullness and laxity.
And when you're visualizing, you can only, for me, it seems that I can only focus on one thing. So let's just say you're visualizing Chenrezig and also reciting the mantra. So, I mean, I can really only focus on one thing.
Okay. So, yeah. So this question comes a lot because you're visualizing and you're reciting the mantra. But it seems like you can only focus on one thing. You know, we can eat and read the newspaper at the same time.
But not in the same concentrated way.
Not in the same concentrated way. But so sometimes what you can do is emphasize the sound of the mantra, and the visualization isn't as clear, but your main focus is the mantra. And other times, the mantra, you put that kind of more on automatic and focus more on the visualization. So you can balance them in different ways.
And so when you are putting your focus on one or the more strongly, for me, if I'm not really holding on to that visualization, then I either get, with whatever I'm thinking, I either go to just... Or excitement in some way.
Oh yeah, you can see those are the two main hindrances, aren't they?
Yeah, so I really have to just be continually putting my mind back on it.
Right.
Just constantly.
Yeah, again and again.
Again and again.
Again, you put your mind back on it. Don't squeeze. Don't squeeze.
Well, that's
okay?
Kind of how it seems. Yes.
Yeah, but it's kind of like when you're bringing up a small child, you know, the kid runs away and you bring him back, and he runs this way and you bring him back, and he runs that way and you bring him back. Mm-hmm. Okay, And so you just keep bringing your attention back. But don't get irritated, you know, and don't get squeezing like, okay, I've got to stay on the object, you know, because, yeah, don't squeeze like that. But have more of a relaxed awareness that's still, you know, alert and focused on the object. But there's some kind of relaxed quality in it. Not relaxed in the sense of, oh, I'm going to let my mind go everywhere it wants to. But relax in the sense that you're not sitting there squeezing yourself. I've got to see Chin Resi. I've got to see this. I've got to, you know, that kind of thing. Because that's the kind of attitude with which we approach many things in our life. You know, I've got to master this. And that kind of attitude just becomes a bit of a problem.
But there's some force to it though, right? There's inertia behind it. It's not relaxed.
Relax. Things can be relaxed and have energy at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, when I lead you through the body scan, whenever we have teachings in Newport, and I lead people through the body scan, remember at the end I always say, and you're aware of your position, which is firm and relaxed at the same time. And I say that every time, very deliberately, you know, because if we can feel, how does it feel to have my body be firm and relaxed at ease? You know, well then, how can I transfer that to my mind when my mind is firm, but it's also at ease, it's not tight? Because we usually think of relax as, you know, and that's not actually relaxing. I don't think the mind is really relaxed at that time. The mind is more scattered and distracted. But I don't think scattered and distracted is the same as relaxed.
Because it takes a lot of energy, right? And so much. After meditation, it takes so much energy. Sometimes it is really tired.
It takes energy, but you can't sit there and squeeze and like, oh! You're not doing the bathroom on the cushion, okay? You're not trying to deal with a constipated mind, okay? You're just, you know, Chin Resi's there. You're just looking. Yeah? Chin Resi's there. And you're seeing Chin Resi.
Sometimes it's not to say, just starting thinking about some of these things really takes off sometimes, and it gets a lot of energy behind it, and then it's like I can't stop it. And then, like at night, I'm so wound up, I can't go to bed. I have to stay up and study, and then I'm tired in the morning, and I just hate it. But I just can't turn it off. It's just
what's going on in your mind?
Just, you know, because from one, you start thinking about something, and I don't know if it's because, you know, for a lot of the antidotes that I use are things from the long run.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start thinking about them, and then I'll find a point that will get me more interested in it, mm-hmm. and then I'll want to look at it more.
Oh.
Then I'll find another point, and I'll want to look at it more. And it just keeps going and going and going like that. So it has a lot of energy, and it's just, I don't know.
Yeah. So your mind's thinking in a positive way.
Yeah.
You're not being spaced out.
You're
being really, you know, in this word, it's not coming.
It's interesting. It's like, but it needs to calm down because I have to go to bed and you
know,
get up in the morning.
Yeah, so at that point, you have to say, okay, I'm going to go to sleep and let this kind of go on, you know, how does it do it, you know, when you have one program on and, you know, the other one's in the background. Yeah, let it be subliminal in my sleep. yeah, or let it be running in the background, or just, you know, I have to rest my body and mind right now, and may this, you know, sometimes you can even, in your sleep, you know, insights will come to you about different points. So, you know, look at your sleep as, you know, I've got to rest my body right now in my mind. But it doesn't mean that I have to completely let go of this topic, and, you know, it can be there subliminally while I'm sleeping and kind of going deeper. But also see, because maybe you don't need as much sleep as you see, as you think you do, unless you're really having a hard time getting up in the morning.
This week, is the contrary of her, because she has like 10 books she needs to study to know the details of the chemical component of the nectar of two eggs. and take notes, and she's good. But I am the contrary. This week, it's been very helpful for me when I started being in a good meditation mode since last week, since after we talked. It has improved wonderful. And what works, like I said, is meditation. I'm really focused. I'm not good in the mornings, you know. I'm not good in the morning. But once, you know, I have my morning nap. But what has, you know, it has been improving, and what I really have noticed is that I remember Mary called me. She guided a meditation earlier this year that I was around. And she emphasized, instead of saying the prayers and developing the feeling and the emotion that goes with the prayer, instead of saying how wonderful it would be that all sentient beings, you know, were having partiality and this and that, you just imagine beings and how all these sentient beings have a mind with no hate and no attachment. So I've been focusing on instead of saying, which I learned the Sarana from heart since long ago, instead of saying it, even with a visualization, I'm not, you know, it's really juicy for me to not, of course I use words, but even in the visualization, for example, I'm not saying the second arm is holding a mala, I'm just looking at it and see what, and even feeling, you know, the beats of the mala, how they feel and how they are posed in the hand and what they tell me, and, you know, all these things, and the seven link practice prayer is like amazing. Because it's like you confess and then you rejoice and you do all this, you know, offerings and you rejoice, which is the best part, the rejoicing of from ordinary to realized beings. So I've been focusing on that, and I feel, you know, it's the mandala, instead of saying the word, just visualizing a world that is so perfect and enlightened, and all these beings, and then you divide them in continents, and you put their jewels, and this is the world you want to create, inspire for the, I mean, I really, you know, but at the same time, I have noticed that I am verbal. I'm talking and I'm imagining all these things, like a story, telling a story. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm like, but that part, that the part of the prayers, has helped me a lot to do it backwards, because I know and I do it knowing that this is a part of the marriage, of the creation of marriage, and it's like cleaning the soil, and now that you develop all this quality,
and you can really see through doing all of those you know, the refuge and the four immeasurables and the seven limbs, you can see how when you really focus on it, there's a definite change in your mind.
Oh,
yeah, nice. And you can feel that purifying effect, and you can feel what it means to collect a store of positive potential, you know, to have that basis.
It has helped me a lot to, like, I don't see sentient beings around me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I see, like, well, I try, I don't know how I see it, but like minds, so mm-hmm. perturbed and so discursive and so, you know, with so many affected emotions. And I see all this, and then, you know, with all these prayers and all these desires and all these aspirations, all those minds, like mine,
mm-hmm.
and that has helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's just, you know, not all of the sessions are like that.
Yes.
I've had a lot of reflections also
mm-hmm.
about the devotion to the teachers, also to how great they are. For me, it's very important. And it is because of teaching that we can have these techniques, and that is their effort.
Mm-hmm.
And being a child of the lineage is
mm-hmm.
Christ.
Yeah.
I have also thought a lot about what I mentioned before. I don't know when. The life of a lay person in the Dharma,
mm-hmm.
and how somehow the Dharma that has come to the West is Americanized and become Western.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Buddhist tradition in Tibet, and there's the Zen, and there's the Chinese, and the Theravadas, and all of them have adjusted to a culture. Now how all this knowledge and wisdom have come here and are adapting here, how precious it is, because it's so fragile and it's so new, it's just 35 years here.
Mm-hmm.
And how we can contribute to that in our lives mm-hmm. in a monastic way, which is the rarest, because I was reading, I don't know how I came out to start finding all these articles and all this about how the West is, how America and the West is developing a Buddhism that is for the lay people to really work. I mean, not to the levels of the monastic, but before, Buddhism was in the monasteries in India. They destroyed the monasteries, Buddhism was gone. And in Tibet, it wasn't the monasteries where all the knowledge was, and a lot of people, you know, were just religious people. But here, Dharma has really spread into us all, and that's a big responsibility to change your life and to mark, like that, without even saying words, mark the difference of who you are and who you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
In your life. Without saying anything, just practice. So, a lot of
stuff. Good.
Physically, at night, I have this acid.
You can think of how all sentient beings have been your mother and what they've gone through carrying you.
Mm.
We get enlightened that, wow, we're going to save a lot of people a lot of problems, aren't we?
I also know that, like, I see my meditation sometimes is going good and everything, but it's just so small, you know? But at the same time, it's so important.
Yeah.
But still.
It's small and it's important at the same time. Yeah. And it's big. too. From another viewpoint, it's big.
Humongous.
Yeah, when you think of before, you know, what you're doing now is huge.
Well, I was thinking today, if I live 20 more years, and the Abbey's really thriving, and there's lots of people here, will you let me just go on your treatment and stay there? When there's no more haunted jobs, can I just go on your treatment and stay? Oh, I'm really loving this and having, you know, a little bit of self-comfort about going home, but I've been pushing it aside. Mostly, I think for me, what's been so incredible is a chance to be a student in a way. Like, I'm going in the study time, I'm going through my notes from the teachings, and then I'm making notes about what to then take and meditate on. And I've never, I don't think I've ever had such an extended period of time to be able to really take what I just heard and then go through it and then go sit with it. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I just love that I can get up from one session, and if it's a terrible session, nope, I'm going right back, it's okay. You know? And there aren't so many terrible sessions, really, but that's, and then I'm also very much appreciating your book on this practice, because I'm really focusing on the intimate part. So I'm getting that, my understanding of it, and then going to meditate with it. And, so mostly, it's just really, I love it. I feel like I'm learning a lot, but I'm not sure I can articulate it. You know, this whole idea of how, of manifesting, you know, trying to see all phenomena as imputed, you know, and that in meditation, the things that I'm visualizing, the manifestation of the wisdom mind, and trying to see their emptiness at the same time. It's like that's plenty to work on. But it's good. It's really. Yeah. And I also had an insight that I need to write this up, I guess. It's maybe a website sort of thing, but this is a life issue, right? There's this parable, this Christian parable about the talents. Jesus told the story. I can't remember even now the details, but somehow a man gave three talents to three children or something. And told
what?
Talents.
How can you give a talent?
Well, actually, it was a coin. I don't know if you know the Bible. Mm-hmm. But the whole teaching is really ingrained in me about use your talents and you go out and use them well and to help people and stuff like that. And it has, in a way, it has been a really, not a positive force. I mean, it's been that, but it's also, I felt like this responsibility that in some, because I was in theater, and you know, like, use your talent this way, use your talent this way, use your talent this way. There's all these worldly ways that I felt fully bound up in use the talent. So, I'm meditating on this opportunity I have of being here, and I thought, this is the talent. This is the talent you're supposed to use, ding dong. Here you have this incredible opportunity. Blah, blah, blah. Listen. None of that worldly stuff was the talent you've been stressing out about all these years. It was it. It was such a duh. But in a way, it was a thing. Kind of open to go, oh, this is the thing that is the most precious. And so that's what my job is. To use these things. So that was a very big kind of a bondage, that kind of that parable, that Christian teaching that's just been like bound up for 50 years. Okay.
Because use your talents meant
your specific worldly skills.
Exactly. Use your worldly skills and worldly ways to help people. That's what it was for.
Yeah.
That's the use that's proper and right and kind of God command it. But even if you die out of it, there's still that command to help people in that way.
Yeah. That there's many other ways to help people.
Yeah. And also the very narrow view of what that
is. Of what helping people means.
Yeah. And also the very narrow view of what the quote talent is.
Somehow through practice, you know, I think part of what happens is that just by who you are, that helps people. Because right, you know, at the beginning, our idea of helping people is, okay, I've got to have a skill. So I've got to learn, go to school, and I've got to have a skill. And then I've got to know how to put that skill. I've got to learn techniques. Mm-hmm. You know, give me a technique. Because that, you know, I mean, in this country we are so into techniques, aren't we? You know, give me a technique, something that I can do, you know, and that's what's going to help. And we get quite tangled up in that, you know, because we can do all of our techniques up and down, and whether they help or not, you never know, you know. But then you see some people, just who they are helps. You know, they don't have to say anything, they don't have to do anything, but it's the qualities that they've developed inside their own being that wherever they are, they're helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, I was thinking today, because they talk about how when a bodhisattva breathes, just a bodhisattva breathing creates so much positive potential and is so beneficial, you know. And like, when you first hear this, you go, huh? You know, somebody breathing? But then, if you think, you know, inside that mind of a bodhisattva, you know, everything is done, the whole life is lived from the perspective of what is the best thing for everybody in the long term, and how can everybody arrive at lasting happiness? So, if you have that kind of motivation and you breathe, you know, it's incredible benefit to sentient beings, isn't it? Because just one person sitting there having that motivation, even they're not doing anything, on a, I hate this word, but psychic level, you know, on the level of just mental energy, because mental energy is incredibly powerful. But just somebody having that kind of mental energy in the world, you know, I think can be really, really effective. Because we usually think energy, you know, okay, there's gas energy and there's wind energy and there's, you know, we always think of physical energy, but we don't look at the mind that moves the physical energy, and that's why we wind up with such a mess on the planet. But if you think of developing that kind of mind, that, you know, and how that mind can influence the world. Because we don't just influence each other by what we say and what we do, just by what we think, you know. I mean, it's like if somebody is really violent and walks in this room, you feel it. They don't have to do anything, but you feel it, you know. And if somebody is compassionate and they walk in that room, you feel it too. And so sometimes just by who we are, you know, that becomes something very powerful. And you can really see it when people go to do hospice work, you know, because when you go to do hospice work, you know, you feel real insecure. Give me some techniques. Tell me what to do. Okay, well, when somebody says this is the kind of thing I have to say, and when they say that, this is the kind of thing I have to say. That's not what helps people. I think it's who you are as a person and your ability to feel what's going on and be there, you know? So, you know, I think when we have that aspiration to help, I think so much of it can be activated by changing what's inside of our mind, you know, because that can become so helpful. Without thinking of doing anything. Yeah. And I just think of that day, and I just say this because at the county health department talks about it. It was a Friday afternoon, and Eric and I, our architect, you know, and I went into his office, it was the first meeting with him. Poor guy comes in, he's just like at the end of the week and the end of the line, and we talked to him, and at the end he said, oh, I feel so much better. And we're just asking him about, you know, how to do the septic system and the water system and things like that, you know? I mean, we're not sitting there like, okay, here's somebody, how am I going to benefit him? We're just being who we are. Yeah? But it has some kind of effect. And so I think lots of times, you know, when we change who we are, then who you are just in the middle of that. And you feel this when you go into a prison. Don't you feel it when you go to a prison? You know? You just go in there. You know, you don't have to sit there and then blah, 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 you know? I mean, yes, speaking the words and saying things is an extra added benefit. But as you walk across that yard, you know, you can be a benefit. You can be a benefit or you can be a harm. Depends on what's going inside of your mind. I mean, so much, it just comes from inside. And that's why I think the whole mindfulness practice is very helpful. When we ask ourselves, when we're mindful, how am I walking? You know? Because you're mindful not just, because the mindfulness is this big buzzword, you know, I don't think people really know what that means very much, but everybody talks about it. But, you know, am I walking with kindness? How am I walking? What am I expressing by the way I'm walking? And what's going on in this mind that's motivating the walking? Yeah? Because that's expressing something to the whole rest of the world that is around us. So I think very often if we can, I think it's a good practice of mindfulness, you know. How am I wiping the table? Am I wiping it with the mind that wants to get this darn chore done already? or am I wiping it? Just because it's a wonderful thing to do, and I'm cleaning off the negative karma from the minds of sentient beings.
Now that you were talking about how powerful the mind is, I just remember I had a question. I want to deepen my understanding of the dedication. I understand that when we dedicate towards enlightenment or towards the benefit of all sentient beings, that my mind really can understand that the seed stays in the mind and will, you know, eventually grow and will not be destroyed. But we dedicate for people, for example, that we don't know for success or something, or the people that died who we don't know, or people that we might know or be very close to us.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, you know, that the importance of aspirational prayers and all this, but I would like to know more about how dedications work. I mean, I can dedicate for Carrie, and what? How will she be transformed? Or
mm-hmm.
How will her mind, or will she feel something? Like, I don't
yeah.
get it.
Well, I think, you know, that this is really the power of the mind, because if you think something positive about somebody, I mean, that energy is there, you know? And I think what the dedication does is it creates a positive atmosphere so the person's own good karma can ripen. But they've done some studies and people who have been prayed for recover quicker. You know, I mean, the mind is tremendously powerful that way. I think when we dedicate, you know, because we get a lot of requests, you know, here to pray for different people and to dedicate for them. The dedication benefits them. The dedication also benefits us. Yeah? Because here's this person that we don't know at all, but all of a sudden we're involved in their life. And we don't know them at all this life, but how did we know them in previous lives? And where are they now? I mean, I was really struck when we got the dedication to pray for Jorge, you know, Sarah and Julio's son. Because when I was in Jalapa, I met several children. I'm not sure if he's one of them because I'm so bad with names. I've got to find out if he was this one boy that I'm thinking of. But regardless if he's the one that I'm thinking of or not, it just made me think, wow, you know, you have the karma to live 14 years here, and then you're gone, you know? And who you are, this whole identity, it lasted only 14 years. And all those things, you know, your basketball, the toys in your room, your mother and father, everything's gone, you know? And you're on and just propelled by the winds of karma into another life. And then how stunned his family is, I'm sure, in the Dharma community there. You know, because everybody thinks, well, you know, a child can't die before their parents, but it happens a lot. And, you know, like, what's happening to his mind now? And how can the parents feel? And how can the parents make this part of their Dharma practice so that his life had some meaning in a Dharma way for everybody he encountered, you know? So if his short life of 14 years can motivate other people to practice the Dharma well, then isn't that a beautiful gift he was able to give to them,
mm-hmm.
you know? But, you know, you just see, because this whole contemplation comes because you're making a dedication prayer for somebody and, you know, thinking about their life. I was also going to ask you, say, I just heard that a friend of mine died, a venerable Tenzin Yunten. And some of you may have seen her. There's an old picture from 1993 of His Holiness and Venerable Tenzin Pama and me, and she's the third nun. That's
wow.
her. Yeah, she's from Kenya.
Is it a black and white
picture? Yeah. Yeah. So she's that other nun. She's been in Dharamsala for years. And I don't know how she died. They found her sometime around Christmas time. Bia, who's another friend of ours, said that. She walked in the room and she was sitting in meditation position looking very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what she died of. It didn't say. I had to find out. But, you know, she wasn't very old. And, she apparently remembered to meditate at death. And apparently when one lama, one of her teachers, came and did pola for her. But when they told His Holiness,